This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome, coaches, to the Talking Split Podcast. I am Rob Calder, the Coach Development Coordinator at Basketball Victoria, joined today by the High Performance Coach for the Victoria Metro Men, Darren Best. Welcome, Bestie.
Hello, everyone.
And joined as well by the High Performance Coach for the Victoria Country Women, Zoe Carr. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure to have you both in. As a reminder, you can follow along on the podcast on both Instagram or on X using the @TalkingSplit handle. Zoe has rolled her eyes heavily. Bestie's looking at me like, what the hell is that? Is that another social media platform that I'm not a part of? Yes, it is.
Well, I was going to sign up for Twitter, and now that it's changed, it's gone. I'm out.
You've got to draw the line somewhere.
Yeah, I'm done.
It's completely understandable. So with a number of associations at the moment announcing trials and trial dates and all those types of things around the state, there'll be country teams looking to select for their coming season. There'll be VJBL associations looking to get started as well. Thought it was a good time to discuss what can make your selection trial run a little bit more smoothly from both an admin perspective and from an on-court perspective. Both of you are about to go through trials as well from the high performance area, so keen to get your thoughts on what it will look like in that space as well, whether it's an easy thing to get done or whether it becomes a little bit harder to get done depending on where you're at. So what we will look at to start off with, so how many trials is too many trials? So we speak about it a lot, and I'm keen to get your thoughts on this, Bestie, because you've just come from an association space probably more recently than probably so both Zoe and I have. How many trials did you used to have, and was it enough to get it right?
Yeah, so we went through some changes after my first year there. We had a non-rep trial first. So if you weren't in rep previously, you would go to that, and part of that was due to the environment out there. It was rapidly expanding, so there was lots of kids coming. You know, we would have somewhere between, 800 and 1,000 kids trial for the whole thing, which was just manic. So we would have that trial first, and then initially it was 5 trials for rep. And I was like, wow, it's just way too much. So we cut it down to 3. But I know this is another talking point, but I would rank the kids in my role. So we would have kids starting on certain baskets, which helped with that. So you would come in from what we called phase 1 domestic trial if you hadn't played rep before. If you'd played rep at another club, that was fine. You would join the phase 2 rep trials. Yeah, but then everybody would be pre-placed on courts.
Yep, and that was based on where they'd played previously, or was that based on...
Yeah, a little bit of both. So yeah. I had a depth chart of every kid in our program. So I would... A little bit was where they played, a little bit was where I think they could be.
Yep, that makes a lot of sense. So Zoe, on your end, you're dealing with camps. Obviously, you get one hit at these kids. And if they're good on the day, great. If they're not, it makes it very difficult to select them. Like, how does that work in the country space, I suppose? Like, how much pre-knowledge do you need to have of some of these kids before they come in?
Yeah, so we have to make sure we have knowledge of everything, really, that they're participating in. Things like country champs is a big one for us that we make sure we get eyes on. Now, we're not always there in person, but we are always watching. And VJBL and things like that. One of the things I think a misconception, though, that comes through is that, a player does X, Y, and Z on a Friday night, which means they should automatically be put in the state team or automatically be in SDP. And it's not actually the case. There's far more that goes into that but having that knowledge of what they're able to do in those environments and who they are in those environments too. Are they a player that you want, or an athlete that you want that's a good teammate and, is good for a program? So, all those sort of things come into play, and regardless of whether that you've got one go at it or 3 goes at it, that's the sort of information you need to be aware of.
Because it is different. Like, you can get, if you're dealing with 800 to 1,000 kids, obviously, that's a lot of feedback you're going to potentially have to give depending on how your selections have gone. But there is a lot in that too that you've got to take into a lot of things into consideration when you are selecting kids for this, because a lot of associations will be going through trials in, say, October, but finals aren't until August, September. So trying to pick, is this the right kid now versus is this going to be the right kid when the season kind of matters, I suppose, for lack of a better term, is really difficult to get done, and that's not easy. And especially that 12s to 14s, I don't believe is a massive jump physically. Like the good kids, I think, can translate from, say, a 12-1s team into a 14-1s team, and they can kind of make it work. That 14-1 to 16-1 jump, though, that is...
In boys in particular.
Boys especially. Yeah. Like, that is
not so much in the girls, but definitely in the boys.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, do you see many kids go from a 14-1s to a 16-1s bestie, or do they sort of tend to go through like a twos or a threes first?
Oh, it happens a lot at the smaller associations.
Yep.
Yeah, obviously. But, yeah, less and less. Yep. And I will say, you know, obviously with our HP stuff, things are done differently. We have our selections for our state teams closer to competition time, as opposed to VJBL having trials for when their, you know, I guess their finals would be.
Yep, it's season starting, like grading happens and all that sort of stuff, which they need kids for. But yeah, you're not necessarily dealing with the what's right in front of you, I suppose, is probably the big thing. Any benefits that you've seen, Zoe, in going like super early or super late with your trials? Say at a VJBL level, for example, like what are the benefits of both?
The only benefit I can see of super early is getting more time with your team together, and but the downside to that is that's the really small window of the year where they could actually have some time off and, you know, get off legs a little bit and maybe miss the game and enjoy it. So I'd say that the benefit doesn't outweigh the the cons. On the other side of that, going super late, you run the risk of athletes being snapped up by other associations. And, you know, if they're trialing at multiple clubs and they finish and they say, yep, you're in our ones, they might just go, yeah, okay, well, at least I know I'm in a ones, because, again, another misconception is that you have to be in the ones. And whilst in certain levels and certain ages it does become important, but particularly younger, if it means you're going to play in the twos or sit in the ones, play in the twos. You know, you're not going to get better sitting and watching. But I would say, yeah, going late, you run that risk of somebody, another club, offering them a position and them taking that, and then you lose them. But, I don't really see an issue with any of them. The one thing I would like associations to start doing is to stop being held hostage by athletes. You know, you do see, and Bestie could probably speak to this a little bit more in his previous role, but athletes that are, oh, well, we're trying out over here and not making their decision and trying and holding teams, you know, you're holding a place for them and all that sort of stuff. And I think that just creates a really ordinary environment from the get-go. I think we've got to get okay with just coaching the kids we've got, and I think you know, if we can, kids are going to move, it's inevitable, but I think because of the size of transfers that we have now we're getting caught sort of, we want this kid, and then the kids that have been there with you since, you know, bottom age under 12s are sitting there not sure if they're in the team or not because you're waiting for this other kid to make a decision. And I just, you know, it's that sort of stuff that I just think we've got to take a little bit of power back, I think, in that sort of scenario.
Did you have rules around that, Bestie?
Yeah, like, I did. I'll just go back to the first question though, but I will come back to that. I think there should be mandatory time off after the season before anyone is allowed to have a trial. I think that needs to be implemented ASAP. I also think that you should only be able to trial within a selected ranges of postcodes. You know, I think it's important to be able to have more than one option.
Yep.
Right. I do get that. But I think if you're in postcode A, you should only be able to go and trial or play for association A and B, for example. Yep. There's just too many kids spending way too long in the car traveling, you know, to go and play for associations. It's really no benefit compared to where they're at. So super early, like everything Zoe said. Super late, everything Zoe said. What I found was that we would often have ours on at the same time as some other associations that were similar size, and then there's some that would be, you know, they're not around anymore, but like Hampton Park, for example, and even still to this day, like Keysborough, they would have theirs after and pick up basically who didn't get a spot. Right. So There's a little bit of that. But as far as so there used to be a permission to train form, and then there was a clearance, right? So if an athlete that was in our program came to us to ask for a permission to train, I wouldn't give it. I would just clear them and say, see you later, you're out. That was the rule. So if you're in or you're out. So if you want to go and trial somewhere else, cool. We won't consider you anymore. And did it cause some problems? Yeah, sure. But then look at what happened to the club, right? Yep. It got way better. There was one time where I signed one. And that was this particular athlete had gone the whole way through Casey. He was going into his top age under 18s year. And the dad said he really wants to play for Casey, but he knows he's not going to make it because I'd reduce the number of teams that we're going to have in 18s. But he still really wants to play basketball. And I was like, okay, that's the one time. So he came to trial knowing that he wasn't going to make it. Yep. And then I think he ended up going to like Pakenham or something like that to play. Yep. But yeah, if you're either in or you're out. Now, as far as imports coming in, obviously we would let them come and trial, but we would make them commit to us by a certain time. And if they hadn't done it, we would just say, well, you're out.
Well, and that's the hard part I find is that everyone's looking for this utopian fit that is going to be better. It really doesn't. Like, there's going to be pros and cons to it. And one of the cons might be I'm going to have to travel an extra 25 minutes to get to this new association rather than the association that I'm currently at. So it's a big deal, in all honesty, that associations have to go through is that potentially you'll have 8 to 10 kids from external associations come in and trial with you. That's potentially another team. Now, should you be looking after the kids that are already in your association against bringing players in? I'm certainly not saying you can't bring players in and that sort of stuff. What I am saying, though, this is not a free agent market where you get to trials and it's like, yeah, geez, I think our team's okay. Who else can I go and get from other associations to come on? That's not what this is. Like, there are rules in place for that. So please don't go down the path of just going on like a shopping spree. Nobody has the budgets of English Premier League clubs. Like, you cannot do that.
Well, I think it should be stricter. At the moment, you're allowed two import players per... I think it should only be one.
Yep.
I definitely think it should only be one. And, you know, I'm also hearing of, you know, it's already started. Like, coaches are taking families out for dinner.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, to try and get them to come across.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. So for mine, look after your own kids. Like, there's nothing wrong with a kid that turns up on your doorstep and is pretty good. No problem. Take them if they can make your association better. Those types of things. But just be very mindful that what makes your association is your players.
Correct.
But one thing I will say is that administration needs to be on board that too.
Yep.
So this can't be just look after our players, but then we also expect you to win every VC title in every age group. Because nowhere, that doesn't happen anywhere. So I 100% agree, but I think we get caught too in a situation where administration doesn't meet with what the expectation that they've set on the coaches or the coaching director.
Yeah.
And that is a tough spot to be, and that's where you would hope your director of coaching or your basketball manager or whoever it is on the same page with the admin side of things because – as we all know, when that works smoothly, everything goes a lot better on that end too. So that is a big part of what we deal with at trials is the unknown, I suppose. And I mean, if you have player A that walks into your trials that is clearly good enough to make your first team, how early would you commit to that player and say, hey, you will make a group versus making them see out, say, the three trials that they have to go to? Like, is there a line? Because I know in the past I've committed like session one, like when a kid's walked in the door and it's like, hey, this kid will make this team better and I don't see them knocking out anyone that's currently in that position that really needs to make that team, we'll commit to them on the spot and say, hey, we're in, where are you at? And not apply pressure to get an answer out of it, but just, look, we need to know by a certain date because we need to pick our teams as well.
Yeah, that's what we did. I think it was by the second trial. Yep. I think at the end of the second trial, we'd say, look, are you in or you're out?
Yep.
Yeah. I'd agree with that, end of the second trial. But that's also, again, why it's important to have a restricted number of trials as well. You know, there's a club I was involved in and their trials went for about 4 or 5 weeks. There was 8 or 10 trials. It was absurd. And the anxiety in the athletes was through the roof because it just kept getting drawn out and drawn out and drawn out. And it's one of the – it may be a talking point on the list for a bit later, but – it's one of the really important things you need to do, particularly if you're the first team coach, is you need to have knowledge on your age group and your cohort. There's probably a cohort of about 14 or 15 that you're probably looking through. If we're being realistic, if you're not under 12s, if you're anybody else that's had athletes playing.
Yeah, you should have some knowledge of that.
Yeah.
Group.
And if you don't have that, you need to go find that because you need to pick your team quickly. Like, you don't have three trials. You've got half of one.
Yeah. Probably even. I'd go the other way. Like, if you're the first team coach.
If you can't pick your
team by the end of the first session, something's up.
And it's not to say that you're not giving other athletes an opportunity to make or miss. You are. You're certainly giving it. But I would say you've got 1.5 trials and you have to have that team picked because everybody else is waiting for the cascade that then happens. Mm. You know, the five that you don't pick now go into the twos, which pushes another five down and it just goes on and on and on. And, you know, it's really hard to get people to coach the lower teams, the lower numbered teams. And if they're getting stuffed around because, you know, you can't make a decision between two players that are basically identical, then they're not going to come back because it's them. They're the ones that end up getting hurt by it. So, you know, you need to be in a position, as horrible as it probably sounds, you need to have your knowledge on your age group and on your athlete, and you need to pick quick.
Yep. The other thing that we started implementing too when I was at Casey was you're allowed to change your teams up until after Australia Day. So we would put in all of our stuff. You've been selected to team whatever, but we reserve the right to. And we would. Sometimes we would move kids.
Yep. How did that go? Like when you moved a kid down, for example, how was that taken?
A couple of times really well, particularly in the younger age groups because they could see they were a bit like, wow, I'm a bit overwhelmed. Some others maybe, you know, a little disappointed, but – I mean, you guys know how I am. I was like, you know, you agreed to this, you know. So, yeah.
There's no point trying to go through the bargaining phase of the seven stages.
Just get to acceptance.
Like, just get to acceptance as quickly as you can.
But it was always around, look, there's a reason we're doing this. We think it's, you know.
It's not flippant.
There's
some history here. Right?
And here's how we're going to help you to, you know, blah, 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 maybe get better and up to a point where you're not considered for that next time.
And it's the same thing I mentioned before. Being in a... use ones and twos, for example, being in a ones and just sitting and watching versus being in a twos and being a major part of that team, be in the twos. Like, you know, but that also comes into, I don't think our teams should have more than 8 in them anyway, but that's probably a different pod.
It probably is, to be fair. But it is something, I know I've done this before. I coached an age group in 16s. I moved up to 18s and it was the same kids coming up. And I had a kid trying out who I kind of knew a bit about, was a bottom age kid. And it's like, yeah, look, he's okay. Like, he'll be serviceable in that team. A kid came across and trialed from another club. And it's like, hey, shiny new toy. Like, this kid might look a little bit better now. And, you know, think of the upside that I can possibly get with this kid that I don't have in the other one. Picked the kid that was external. 2 weeks in, realized I've butchered this decision completely. Like, I've made a meal of this one. Rang the kid. The kid's like, no, I understand it. Like, it's, you know, I haven't been great. You know, I'm happy to go down. Mum was super happy, like, yep, appreciate you letting us know. Yeah. We'd rather go down as well. Dad, not so happy with it. No. Is there any chance you can stay? No, look, we've kind of made this decision. Like, we're bringing somebody else up. Kids still had a pretty good season, still trained with us and all those types of things, but it is something that you can get a little bit lost in the whole, the new toy.
Yeah, I think the key to it's just to have your policies and procedures in place.
Yep. It's easy to refer back to.
Yeah, it's like, you know, this is what we said. It's possible.
Yep. So... you've spoken a little bit about pre-selecting kids to be on courts. That, for mine, that has to happen.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with that whatsoever. It just enables you to get a head start. Look, because realistically, the first half hour of every training session or trial will probably look the same thing, where there's this little bit of feeling out period of who's that, where are they going to be at. And at least if you can have them on the right courts with similar level kids, you can now start to make assessments on it. You don't need the kid that's potentially in like high performance programs beating down on some poor kid that's only ever been in like the fours or the fives.
No, it's a complete waste of time.
Yeah, it hurts the kid that's only ever been in the four and fives, and the kid that's in high performance programs probably doesn't really commit to, I'm going to go as hard as I possibly can in that space. So it is something that I think can be done. Does it require a bit more admin? Absolutely. Like, there's no question, but I do think it makes a lot of a difference in that space.
Well, having those sort of matchups as well, it muddies your selection because you can't see what that lower kid is capable of because they're outside of their skill set, they're outside of their level. And so, you know, that they could be a kid that maybe would fall into the threes, but watching them against a high performance kid, all of a sudden you're like, oh no, put them in the sixes. You know, yeah. Because that they look like that kind of a level kid against somebody well outside of their level. So it's you know, they get there's this stigma around having courts and things like that, and you hear it, the collective groan from the sidelines when you put kids into their courts and, you know, oh, she's on the, you know, the 3-4 court or, you know, that sort of stuff. And I get it, but it doesn't mean they can't move. You know, it's just a starting point to be able to then make those adjustments. Kids move up and down courts all the time.
Yeah.
And it's just how you approach it. So I remember I had an athlete that I had on the 3-4 court who probably was more so should have been on the 2-1-2 court, but the previous trial just didn't care, wasn't trying, there was no effort, no intensity, there was nothing like that. So I was like, oh well, you can move down to this court here. And then she didn't come back for the third trial, which is fine by me, but it was just a bit of a, hey, you're not just going to walk into this team. Like, and she was someone like everyone assumed was going to make the ones, but it's like you've got to treat this with the same sort of respect you would treat the ones, and she wasn't, so she got moved and then she didn't come back, and it turned out to be a bit of a blessing in disguise. So, you know, I think the stigma around having courts, pre-selected courts, or moving kids up and down courts, I think we've just got to try and banish that as best as possible. It's actually for the benefit of the athletes, not for anything else, as long as coaches and selectors are doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I think it's good to move them, and it probably opens up to my next point, and I think you probably know where I'm heading with this one, Bestie. Thoughts on having parents involved at trials. So do you allow them to come in and watch and sit on the sidelines or anything like that? Do you say, drop your kid off and we'll catch you in an hour and a half? Like, where did you sit with it?
Yeah, no parents. The first thing is, so at the process would be at Casey, the parents would bring their kids to the foyer, and we had volunteers there with, so the kids would check in and register. They'd be given their number and they would also be told what basket they're on, right? And parents weren't allowed to go past there. That was just, they weren't allowed in it. Sometimes we'd have parent coaches. They were not allowed to be on that basket. And then they were obviously not allowed to be in the discussion around their child. So when that happened, we would ask them to leave. And if it became obvious that it was going to be a parent coach, that wouldn't be decided until literally like the last trial. You know, like when it's almost set in stone. But, you know, even with our HP stuff, you know, like we joke about it, but, you know, I'd send the parents on their way often, and the kids have spoken. They've told us that they don't like it there. They don't like the parents being there. They feel anxious. It detracts from their performance. You know, often you'll see them checking their parents on the sideline. You know, and we have our youth forums and all that stuff. They tell us this. They don't like it. You know, it's just a whole nother level of complexity for them that they have to deal with. So that's why we don't have them in. And, you know, I would also say, if you don't trust us with your child, you know, take them to another club. Don't be in our HP programs. You know, go somewhere else. Play golf.
Play golf. They can sit there and watch you from four holes away. They'll make a
fortune if they're
good. Yeah, I was going to say, if they're pretty good at it.
Yeah, but it's like, this is the thing. Like that. It's, we've all seen it. The parents on the sideline just creates anxiety. We've had some athletes tell us they don't even want their parents to come to games. That's
the
truth.
It also makes it harder for coaches too, having to worry about where parents are, what they can and can't say.
Definitely.
Because you need to have conversations, like, but ones and twos coach, or even with your director of coaching, and you need to be able to, you know, sort of say, hey, where are you seeing your group at the moment? And you need to be able to list that without fear that somebody's listening, and there's always someone listening. So, mm-hmm. It's...
Even when you put your clipboard down and you've circled correct. Some kids and highlighted others and parents are sort of trying to take a picture of it with their phone.
All the little the little codes that I had to try and come up with, just, you know, so there was something on every athlete and some things meant... And it's not hard to crack, but... You know, even having to come up with that was just exhausting. So it's like, it is just easier. And you do see a lower level of anxiety in the athletes when the parents are removed.
100%.
Yep. So you spoke about, and I'm sort of jumping around a little bit on this, but you opened the door for it, Bestie, so I'm happy to walk through it. The post-trial selection meeting in particular. So who gets a say? Is kind of the one I'm more curious on. Does everyone get a say on the first team, or does only the first team coach get a say on the first team? Like, how far would you open that up to other opinions?
Well, once again, you know, I'm a control freak. So,
here's your team.
What's that, sorry?
Here's your team.
Yeah, pretty much. No. The first coach, only the first coach, the director of coaching, the first coach, and... or the age group head coach, because there was times where we had the age group head coach not be the first team coach. Perhaps they would start with a bottom age group every other year or something. So that would be it.
Yep. So did you give, say, the first team coach say on the second, third, fourth teams from there, or were they only responsible for their own team?
If they were solely the first team coach,
yep.
Yeah, that's it. If they also had the age group head role, we would talk about it some. But once again, we had this discussion this morning in our meeting. It all comes down to having people in those roles that you have a good working relationship with, and it's functional. So,
and it should be an ongoing discussion really through the trials anyway. Like, by the time you hit the meeting at the end, you should be pretty much done because you've already had that chat.
To be honest, it starts way before the trials.
Yep.
Way before the trials.
Yeah, just depth chart out what your team could potentially look like. Do I have enough of X, Y, and Z to get a team over the line, etc.? Yeah. So how have you dealt with parent coaches? I say dealt with as if it's like they're the worst people in the world, but how have you managed parents that are going to be coaching their kids in that space? Like, do you involve them from the start and say, look, I feel like your child is going to potentially end up in team 3 through 5, somewhere in there. Would you still be happy to coach it depending on the number? Yeah. But is that the conversation you have with them, or do you do something differently?
Yeah, so in my short stint as a director of coaching, I would not allow parents to coach first teams. That's just was a blanket rule. Then for other teams, they actually weren't involved in selections. Because again, we have to go into a room, we have to be able to have conversations and say certain things. And at some times that may be about their child, which is hard for any parent to hear.
So would they be out completely, or would they only be out when their child starts to become involved?
So they would be at the trials and working on court, we'd go into the meeting. And once their child was selected, they could be involved in the meeting. If they're not, then they basically stay out of it until their child lands somewhere.
And as a director of coaching, you kind of decide where that is pretty much, based on everything else you've seen. Would that be accurate?
And to me, that's the only real sort of fair way to do it, so we don't end up with, you know, the complaints about my child or that person or that kid made this team because their parents coaching or all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I have seen incidents where kids have been, which has been really disappointing, kids have been put in teams simply so the parent coach would coach. You know, they probably should be in a 3s, but they already have a coach for that team, so they put them in the 4s, so then that team has a coach. And that's disappointing to hear that sort of stuff has happened or is happening. So I would hope that we're heading down a track now where particularly with mandatory accreditation and things coming in where that sort of stuff's not going to happen.
So I've had it previously where your illustrious leader was one of the coaches in a program that I was the director of coaching of, and his son was trialling and had made it known that he was happy to coach the team if it got to that point. And we sort of said, well, look, we don't really know if your child's going to make this team yet. Like, we got to work that stuff out first. And it was a case of, until we knew, I was the coach of that team. And at that point, it's like, well, okay, I see this player, you know, I think he sort of said he'd be like the seventh or eighth picked in this team. So it's like, well, look, here's your team up to player number seven or eight, whichever number it was. You are now good to coach this team because we're comfortable that your child is making this group. You can pick the last two spots.
Yep. Mm.
Like, and that was the only fair way we could find to do it because we didn't want to shaft the kid, but you also don't want to lose a coach that is a very capable coach in that space as well. But it is one of those areas that is difficult, and you've got to try and play it correctly because you don't want to offend anyone or upset anyone or anything like that too. Like, there's a lot of good coaches out there that just happen to be parents that have kids involved, and we don't want to lose them from the sport either.
Well, and there's a lot of parents who are coaches that want to be coaches. They're not, you know, they don't want to turn up and be their kid's parent. They want to turn up and they want to coach and they want to try and get through a pathway and all that sort of stuff. So we have to be mindful of that as well. And that's, again, those conversations that you have to have well before trials of, do you want, say, a second team, for example, or do you want the team that your child fits into, because they could be two very different different teams. And you need to know that going in. If you wait until you're in the room and you're making selections and you're doing that to find that information out, you've put yourself on the back foot.
Yeah, it makes it super difficult. So it is a case of, and I think everyone's probably going through it now, where selections are open and you've probably got a list, you know, what's your first preference, what's your second preference, third preference and all that sort of stuff. And if you're a parent out there that's looking to do it, it is quite reasonable to say, look, I'm happy to coach my child wherever they fall. But don't say, I'm going to take the twos in the hope that gets them into the twos. That's just going to cause more problems than it's worth in that space. So please be mindful of that.
Well, and because we have so many parent coaches as well, like, if we didn't, we'd probably be in a bit of trouble. So,
well, definitely.
You know, like, it's really important that we take care of our parent coaches as well.
Yep, and even with assistant coaches in that space, like, I think there are a good chunk of parents that end up being an assistant coach because they're going to be there anyway. Like, it's, you know, do they get a say? Do they not get a say? That becomes a difficult one. How much say do they get? Like, what happens if the assistant coach is more experienced than the head coach in that space? So the dynamic and all those types of things certainly do matter. And, like, I know, having been through a trials, I don't know, what are we up to? We're in August, so we'll say 12 months ago for lack of a better time. You can potentially have up to 14, 15 people in the room all with an opinion on who should be picked. And that becomes difficult to, like, keep the right voices on track so that you know who you're talking to. And it almost is like, okay, first team, give me your 10. 10, done. Right, second team, give me your 10. Done. Third team, give me your 10. Done. Actually, I've got a problem with that. I'm not even sure who you are. Well, how long have you been sitting in the room for? And it becomes that kind of thing because there are just so many people in there, but you want to be able to talk fairly candidly about this because otherwise it's just too time extensive. You can't get it done any other way. Mm. So for mine, it is a difficult spot, but it's kind of what we deal with. So looking at balance, so if you're a first team, you're probably, balance is, I would suggest, probably front of mind as to not have too many bigs or too many guards or whatever the case may be in that space. As you get down the teams, though, balance probably becomes less of a thing you can really concern yourself with, and best player becomes the thing. Like, did you find that, Bestie? Was that something that you focused on as you got down the team? Did you start picking, say, projects for long-term or best player now, or what did you go with?
Yeah, the team number also determined whether what year born you would be. Yep. So we had a couple of age groups where we'd have – say eight teams. So teams one and two would be what we considered like our performance sort of team. So the best kids that can help win in ones and twos. So your ones team is the best team that you can put together. The twos is the next best team. And largely because they would practice together, right? So any combination of top or bottom age, as long as you know, they were up to it. What I would say to any ones teams coaches, and obviously I would have a say in the two, similar to what we spoke about before, if you've got a really good bottom age kid that's probably not going to play a lot, let's put him in the twos, right? Then the threes would be an all top age team. Fours would be all bottom age. We would play the threes and fours against each other right before grading started, and whoever won, we would bump them up into the threes spot, right? Because if they're beating them now as all bottom ages, give it 3 or 4 months, they're definitely going to be beating them. If not, we'd leave them as the fours. The fives would be the last team you could make if you were a top ager. If you were a top ager and you weren't good enough for the fives, you were gone. than it was 6, 7, 8 were all bottom age. Because you need to make sure, for example, if you've got 8 teams, you need roughly 50-50 split between top ages and bottom ages. You need to make sure you've got enough to come up to then fill the quota of top ages the following year. So that's how we would do it. Had one or two, I guess, times where we changed it in 16s where we had a really big kid, like, new to it, that we might have put in the sixes or something like that. But as a general rule, that was it. And then as we went up age groups, we would have less and less teams, and then we would adjust them the same. Yeah. Yep.
And it's, I feel like we keep coming back, as long as you've got a rule and a policy in place, you can navigate this, because like, I remember there would be times where you'd pick a kid in the fives as a bottom ager, for argument's sake. They come in as a top ager and they'd be around about sort of the fours. And it's like, well, you know, that spot really should be going to a bottom age kid to keep balance within the program. And the parents, and rightly so, like if you didn't know any better, you'd be sitting there saying, how can they make a team as a bottom ager but not as a top ager? It's like, well, we're not dealing with the same kid in the same situation in this place. Like we do have to be really mindful of balance of the program.
And this is why for that one time I signed that permission to train, because he was a bottom ager in going into top age 18s, and it was like,
it's going to be tough.
Pretty much we only had 3 teams anyway.
Where do you guys sit on picking an athlete to keep an athlete in a position? So, for example, you've got a 6'5" wing in the boys.
You're talking to about 1% of the coaches out there at the moment. If you're lucky. So yeah, I'm joking.
A big wing, if that's better. And your next best player, there's two players that play big but aren't bigger than them, that maybe aren't the best in the best 10. Do you pick them or do you not?
We were sitting in the chairs that we sit in now, we would like to hope so.
Yes, that's it.
Absolutely. And we see it a lot. I think we've spoken about it a couple of times with, say, Southern Cross. The amount of kids that come in that are big, long, athletic kids that play on the wing for the first time in their lives, and like, wow, this is not something I deal with normally. Like, normally I go back to my club or my association and I end up in the five. Like, and they can't play out there because that's what they have to do for their association. But if you can have, and it sounds horrible, stick with me, unfortunately, out there, people, a couple of sacrificial lambs, so to speak, that are almost, well, you're going to take the brunt of playing that post position so we can keep this kid in a position they're going to play long term, I think that's a good outcome for everyone.
Is that a directive you would have given at Casey?
In certain instances, Yep.
Were coaches okay with that?
Wait for it. Yeah.
They would be, or they wouldn't be coaches for me anymore.
They didn't really have a choice. You know, like...
No, it's
often, I'm heard that there's a carrot that comes with a stick, but, you know, the stick is just bigger.
It's the same every week from him. It's but it makes sense. Like I genuinely believe that that's the right thing to do. Like for all kids. Like if your best chance of success is being an undersized post, go and be an undersized post. Like there's nothing wrong with that in that situation. So if that you happen to be the fortunate kid that skill set translates and the situation works out, I'm good with it. Are you the same, Zoe, or are you different? Or
is I'm the same. No. I was just interested to see because. Yeah, it can mean that players that may normally make the ones don't. Yep. But that's where you've got to weigh up long term versus now. You know, if this player has a chance of progressing, playing in this position because of their natural gifts and talents and things like that, and you can foster that, that's also a part of our responsibility. In clubs as well, I think, or associations.
It's the responsibility.
Yeah, and I think, I know participation is a big part and getting kids playing and getting them loving the game and all those sort of things. But I think sometimes we maybe get a little blinded by everything equal and sometimes a result of that is that those top-tier kids probably get maybe not looked after in the way that they need to for their development. So, you know, I think there's got to be a bit of a blend, but I think, you know, in those sort of situations, if you've got an opportunity to further an athlete's development in that sort of situation, definitely take it.
It really needs to be a association-led directive, though.
Yes, you can't put it on the coach.
No.
That's not fair. But it is, and we're not going to go into the talent identification side of things because I know you guys have your six pillars that you work from anyway, and we'll save that for another podcast. But you have to have something you believe in as a coach or as an association as you're picking these kids. Like, what is your objective? Is your objective to just pick the best kids that play domestic basketball at your association, which is perfectly fine. Absolutely no issue with that. Are you trying to win in that space? Are you trying to give everyone an opportunity to play that wants to play? Whatever your directive is, that's fine. Okay, and blend into that. But also, by the same token, don't hold the best players back to get that. You still want to try and promote them and let them go and be the best version of themselves that they can be too.
Well, and if you're a new coach, going to a new association for the upcoming season, you need to know all of that. What is the identity of the club that you're going to? What are their expectations? You know, all that sort of stuff. Because I do hear a lot of stories of coaches going to new clubs and then finding out they have a, equal minutes policy or something like that in their 18s VC, and that doesn't align with what their beliefs as a coach is. So, you know, all that sort of stuff. So you need to have that laid out from the get-go before you decide where you're going to go or you're going to take a team.
I've said this before. I said on another pod, like, you wouldn't take a job without knowing what you're up for.
Yep.
Right. And I also say this too, if you are on a board or a committee and are there to try and better your child's position and then are going to make the people who pick the team's lives miserable if they don't, right? Just put that on your coaching applications.
Yep.
You know, like,
I'm going to have to navigate this if you come here.
Yeah. Right, because, you know, and I've had that conversation in the past. I said, you know, if you want favoritism for these people, that's fine. Just, like, write that in the brief so we know.
Yep, makes a lot of sense.
Because it does happen.
Oh, I think everyone's got a story of it.
Juniors and seniors.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't change. Like, it's all the way through. So you do have to be really mindful as to who and what you're dealing with in that space.
And I'll double down and say, no, this is actually a good story. No. There are some people that take it really well too. So I'm not going to mention the person's name, but it was at the time a vice president's child that I cut. Wasn't necessarily happy, but understood it and was fine with it and still coached in the program. Like, legend. Really good. Some others maybe wouldn't take it that way.
It's a tough conversation when you walk through the door as well. It's like, I know you've been cut, but I'm going to keep coaching for them. So credit to them for being able to navigate.
Yeah,
that.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, yeah.
That's super impressive.
To be honest, that kid many years down the track came back to coach.
Yep.
Awesome. Amazing. Solid family.
Huge.
Yep. That's phenomenal.
Yep.
Carbon copy them if we could. Content at trials. So as you're trying to make decisions on selections, what are the drills you're looking for? Not three-man weaves. We're going to start off with that. But what would you
horseshoe
be looking?
Horseshoe shooting.
Oh, don't you? I'm a big advocate of as much gameplay as possible. Yep. So, you know, I don't need to see if you can dribble 1-on-0, you know, do a crossover between the legs. I don't really need to see that because the amount of kids that can do that 1-on-0 is probably pretty high. I need to see if you can do that against somebody. So, you know, 1v1. 2v2, 3v3, into 5v5 as quick as possible is more, you know. And I'm not saying you have to go do, you know, however long your trial is, all 5v5. You know, you can break down a part of, if you're the first team coach and you've got that group, you can break, or your club has a club offense or whatever it is, you can break down a part of that and play out of that and see what they're capable of in that sort of skill set. You know, or, you know, play transition games or all kind of, if you want to be a fast-paced team or whatever you want it to be. But, yeah, get into gameplay and decision-making as quickly as possible, if not straight away.
One of the, I don't want to say the worst things I see, but one of the least helpful things I see at trials would be, like, volume shooting.
Mm.
Like, it's just, it makes no sense to me. Like, there's 18 kids shooting the ball at the one ring at the same time. You're not even going to see who goes, whose ball goes through the net. Like, it's, you might get a little bit of a line on, okay, their technique is solid. That's workable, but that's not going to help you. It's, would you be any different, Bestie? Like, how early would you want to be getting into gameplay?
Yeah, quickly. The other thing I would do is we would start the teaching. So when we had trials, we had a lead coach that would run it, similar to how we would clinic our Sunday practices. So
it wasn't the first team head coach, for argument's sake, running the trial. You'd have someone separate coming.
So either I would run it or our development officer would run it. So it would be like we're starting our preseason in trials and we would be building up some receiver stuff. Look, 2-on-1 continuous fast break sort of in the half court, like that's really good for young ages, and we do it in some of our selection camps here. Like it's a quick hit for like 4 or 5 minutes, so some things like that. But if you've got, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hour practice, you should be playing, you know, minimum 3-on-3, 4-on-4, up to 5-on-5 for some, almost like 70% of it, I would think. The other thing that we implemented was some time constraints for the 3-minute run. So the 3-minute run is basically as many laps up and down of the court that you can do in 3 minutes. So down would be 1, back would be 2. And we had some markers. So if you were bottom age 12s, the goal was 21. Top age 12s was 22s. And it would go that way. So bottom age 14s, 23. Top age 14s, 24. All the way up to top age 18s was meant to be 28. Right. And that was, we would do that. And that was an indicator of, you know, some, I guess, fitness goals that we would have. Yeah.
Would it change a selection?
It could do, yeah. Yep. The other thing that we did, you know, the kids started to know it was coming also, you know, so they would prepare for it. But we're going to talk about, like, numbers and all that stuff later, right?
We are. We're about to jump into that now. Okay. So, again, the more scrimmage you can get at your training, there's no better way to assess how your kids are going. And you're in a position too where you might have a 2-court venue but 110 kids. You don't have time to do alley drill. Like, you need to get them into 5-on-5 gameplay within the half court as quickly as you possibly 100%. Can.
The last thing you can afford to have is kids standing around, then not making teams, because that's when complaints roll in and actually have, unfortunately, a leg to stand on because their kids have not really participated in the trial.
Yeah, the one layup that they made, you weren't watching.
Yeah.
Tough kick to be, this coaching business, isn't it? But it's valid. Like, you need to give them every opportunity. And there's part of it too that, there's no nice way to say this. Sometimes we know parents are problems. Like we've dealt with them potentially for 4 to 5 years within the program. They've always got a problem with something that goes on, and you know that whatever team their child ends up in, it won't be good enough for them. Like there are just some people that are like that. It's, you know, we can't sugarcoat that in that space. A lot of cases I see coaches say, well, if they're going to be unhappy anyway, they can go and train on the last court down there and we'll put them wherever they put them. I'd probably go the other way where it's like, nah, go and put them on the main court.
Show them that,
like, show them that their child is not up to this. Like, we come into this with a neutral stance where if they're good enough, great, and if they're not, well, so be it. They fall where they fall. But don't hide them from that, because the only feedback that parent will get is, well, they dominated on that court, so why aren't they higher? So give them the opportunity to fail as well as succeed in those type of situations.
We had this exact conversation just before we had our lunch around our under 20 trials this year. You know, there was an athlete that was, I felt, should have been cut after the second trial, right? We only had 3, you know, and it was probably 60-40 that the athlete should have been cut. We knew that there was potentially going to be some backlash based on some history, and we said, you know what, let's bring him back for the third trial.
Yep.
You know, like, let's just make sure. And the athlete deselected themselves in that trial, because obviously as you narrow the group down, like, it gets the gameplay is better. And so, yeah, that is a factor.
Yep.
Definitely.
For sure. Admin. This is the one thing that coaches hate.
Yuck.
Somewhere Ash Arnott's ears are burning about the admin or the lack thereof. What are some of the things that are non-negotiables for you, Zoe, when we start looking at a selection trial? What are the things that you need from an admin side of things?
As
a coach, but what needs to be done so that you don't have to do it, more to the point?
Obviously a registration list and a pre-numbered registration list, which coincides with the registration list that sits at the front door.
Oh, it's got to be the right one.
It's got to be the same, because I've had that happen before where the numbers then didn't match.
Yep.
So that is a big one. Another part, obviously, things like having the venues booked and and having it advertised and all those sort of things. But making sure too that what the session plans are going to be and for what reason, you know. So, for example, if we're working from the first team down, you know, there's 13 kids barring anybody walking in the door that are probably in line, and two or three or four of them are similar. So in our gameplay, you have to be matched up on you, you have to be matched up on you, and so you can see and get a real gauge and allow yourself the best opportunity to be able to make the right selection and the fairest selection. So all those sort of depth charts, session plans, all that needs to already be taken care of.
And that should be done before you walk in the door as well. That's not an on-the-day thing. That is an email that goes out to your coaching cohort with, this is the session plan, here's where I've roughly got kids looked at the moment. So everyone's aware when they're walking in.
And similar to what we spoke about before, you know, what is the expectation of your association? So if your association has a club offense, you know, that's got to be woven into your session plan, even if you're planning to run other things, you know, because at the end of the day, the reason they've got that is for uniformity and for everybody to be able to participate. So in these sort of situations is exactly why they have it. So, you know, making sure that that features within there and that it's sort of not signed off by your DOC but or development manager or whatever your club happens to have, but all of that has already been checked off and it's all good to go. You need to have – so if I was coaching, say, a 12s, I'd be asking the 16s or 18s coaches to run the sessions if I didn't have somebody to do it for me, in like a DOC or a coordinator or something like that. And then I would do the same. So I would make sure I ran their session for them to give them the best opportunity to see. And also if I'm like an age group head coach or something like that, I'm then also putting coaches where they need to be to make sure eyes, there are all eyes everywhere, because perception is law at the moment. And if, you know, everybody's facing one way, then you are definitely getting and you're not, you know, all backs are to one court, you're definitely finding out about that. Somebody's gonna say something, there's going to be a complaint. So making sure that, you know, okay, you two to maybe three coaches, you're working courts one to three. You two, three coaches, you're working, you know, four to five, whatever. And so then everyone's clear about where they need to be and what their job is at that stage. And then if I was a director of coaching or whatever, I could walk around all of it and make sure I was getting eyes on as well. But because there is a tendency to congregate to the better court because it's fun to watch and all those sort of things. But yeah, just making sure that everyone's getting seen, and so then there's selections, there's no issue with selection, or there's even less of an issue of the worst thing in the world where you get into a room and say, okay, this athlete, and nobody knows who they are. Yep. So
which happens.
It does happen,
especially when you get down lower into the numbers. You might be picking your sixes or sevens, and you may not have a coach for that team yet as you're walking in, and you're looking at everyone else saying, hey, does anyone know this kid? And you hope for the best. And we've all seen it. The lower you get down, I think the more room there is for error in selections, because it's nothing for the eights to beat the sevens or the sevens to beat the sixes or something like that, just because one or two kids hasn't quite ended up where they're supposed to end up. Bestie, any other things that you can think of from an admin perspective?
No, Zoe's touched on it pretty much. Like the numbering, we spoke about that earlier. So making sure they're clear, you know, on both sides of the body.
Arms and legs.
Yeah.
Kids out there, if you're listening, less compression gear.
Yeah.
Like,
we had a system where if they were bottom age, we'd put a line under their number. If they were double bottom age, only in under 12s, we'd put two lines. I think you said different colours, potentially.
We black and red.
Yeah.
That's what we went with.
Potentially that. You know, I invested in about 300 hair ties from Priceline every year, and if it was always boys, it was not the girls. So the girls, like, you obviously understand how to tie your hair back, but the boys.
He's talking to you.
I was gonna say I haven't had to do this until I was maybe eight.
Yeah,
like, I think I was balding at 14.
Yeah, but honestly, the amount of boys that came into trial with like hair all in their face, and I would say to them, like, "Yeah, they're tied up or you're out." And
Bestie may have created the top knot inadvertently.
Oh no! I had some kids asking me to do it, didn't know how to do it, and they had like unicorn horns coming right out of their forehead.
Do you tell them to shave their sideburns?
No, oh. Simpsons. I like it. No, but I was like, you know, like get your hair out of your face, get your hair out of your face. Wear a headband or yep. Tie your hair back.
Yep, makes sense. No, I like that sort of stuff. Like you need to be seen. Like if I could number kids' foreheads, I'd number their foreheads. Like there are times where you simply can't. Like kids are moving up and down at a fairly rapid rate. If you go like one arm and opposite leg and things like that, for mine, I just don't get to see it all the time. You want to remove any possible doubt.
Yeah.
It was one of those things. So I think when we were just coming back from COVID, when we had trials the first time, I think parents had to number their own kids. Mm. And we had it in like size 6 font. We're coming through and it's like, your kid has no chance of being seen in this. Like 48 bold italic, like get everything on that thing to make sure that we know who they are.
Yeah.
It can make a massive difference. Like I know when selection trials go, like you guys make a massive point of making sure you see every single kid and you have something next to them. So that if you do get the question of feedback, you have something for them.
That was going to be another admin. Have your feedback form ready.
Yep.
And, you know, so you're making active notes the entire time. So you're not, if feedback is requested, you're not then having to think about it and do it. It's done. You might have to try and reread your writing, which I cop every now and again. But have it set out. Have it. Make sure it links to your association. Like ours always links to our 6 pillars, whatever your association has. Or if they don't have that, make something yourself and share it. Make sure everybody knows that that's what it is, so then they know that that's what's coming. But I
saw a lot of coaches walking around the last lot of trials with laptops. Like instead of, so rather than having to write it down necessarily, they just type it into the Excel spreadsheet next to the kid. And it's like, well, that's great, but where are you going to put your laptop? At some point, the ball's going to hit it, or you're going to do. So it's kind of fraught with danger, I feel, a little bit. Like iPads, maybe.
Yeah.
Like
one year with Veely, I don't know if you remember, we did like recorders. We had not like recorders at school, like voice recorders. I didn't actually hear the playback, though, to know if it was
terrible. Mine was any good. Yeah.
But. You know, maybe there's something in that. I'm not sure. But either way, having that done and having that set up and ready to go is really important. And all of your coaches that are participating in trials should be doing the same thing and putting those notes in and just having it ready to go. But one thing I will say, though, about trials too, it's one thing to be supplying feedback. It's another to be listening to complaints. Your job is to supply feedback. So if somebody, here are the areas that we believe you need to work on. These are some of the things you do well. Here's how I'd go about doing it. Done. Yep. That's, you know, because if we get caught in this world and it's getting worse and worse at the moment where it just becomes an argument, it's what's going to drive coaches away, yeah, unfortunately.
Most requests for feedback are not so much requests for feedback as to justify why my child did or did not make the team that I thought they were supposed to.
And they want to compare with another child.
And that's the danger.
Never get into that.
Yeah. How many times how many domestic stats have you guys been sent from various competitions?
Oh, all the time. I love that they include the fouls. The big thing with feedback, and we're lucky in our space in that we only provide it for some of our trials. We don't provide it for all of our trials, and that's the luxury that we have in HP. We also only provide it for certain things at certain times, right? So it might be, for example, the state trials, we'll only provide feedback for the last, you know, the kids that go to East Coast Challenge or whatever it might be, right? So, and once again, that's all set up. So you need to go and find out what is the policy for that at your association, you know, because you could be creating unnecessary work. You know, so find out what that is. What was the the stats? Sorry, yeah, really misleading. You know, obviously, it doesn't show field goal percentages. It doesn't show, you know, even
a rebound in most cases.
Yeah, anything. All it shows is total point scores. It might show you know, two pointers made, three pointers made, no sort of percentage, but the fouls, it shows that. And that's, a, you know, I like it. It shows aggression.
Yeah, yeah. I must admit, when I say recruiting in under 12s, when you go into your domestic competitions and you're looking for kids, I would usually go to the box score, and you obviously get your highest scoring kids. But the kids that fouled out every week, I'd go after them as well. It's like, these kids have a dip. Like, if nothing else, we can scale it back if we need to, but they have a bit of a crack.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
And keep sending the fouls through.
And realistically, statistically, most under 12 teams don't shoot free throws really well. So even if we foul them lots, we're not going to get punished for it on the scoreboard.
Here we go. The deficiency.
Yeah, let's foul them.
Yep.
Have some sort of defensive scheme where we don't have to move much. Yeah. We can kind of just protect an area.
Well, in the full court, though, like something that resembles an arrow.
Right at the front?
Yep.
Yeah. In the direction that we're going.
You did that, didn't you?
No, absolutely not. Hand on heart, I can say I've never arrow pressed in my life, in particular arrow press back to a zone. I have run and jumped for sure in under 12s, but I will hand on heart say I've never arrow pressed in under 12s and will never arrow pressed in under 12s. I'm confident of that because I'm not coaching anymore.
Yeah, I think that's... I think for, you know, for us in our space and parents listening, like, don't send us that stuff.
Yep.
Like, it often...
Or don't send your coaches at... Clubland that either. Yeah. Like it doesn't.
It gets an eye roll before it gets let's take this seriously.
Yeah, we're like luckier in metro than country with the fact that we have DOCs and that their role is to communicate about their athletes to us. So I'm sorry, DOCs, but parents send it to the DOCs. Yep. Right? It doesn't need to come to us. It's their job to, you know, filter that.
Makes sense. All right, I reckon that wraps us up for the trials podcast. Coaches, best of luck with it. I know it's a stressful time for everyone, but hopefully this has given you a little bit of an insight as to things you could maybe do better or you can get done to just make the process a little bit smoother. So thank you both for jumping into the podcast. Very much appreciated, and we will catch you all next week, coaches. Love, tune in, enjoy the trial.